Thank you for choosing this Analyst Insight podcast from the Information Security Forum. My name is Mark Ward. I'm a senior analyst at the ISF. And in this podcast, we're talking about cybercrime and cyber threats, a subject, unfortunately, very familiar to a lot of ISF members, and certainly one of the major risks we deal with in the Threat Horizon report every year. Quite a few of the dangers we detail in that derive from those cybercrime groups and the innovations, the new ways they've jumped up to torment organizations. I'm joined today by James Chappell, co-founder and chief innovation officer at Digital Shadows, who certainly knows his way around cybercrimes and criminals from the other side. Hello, James.
Hello.
Good to have you here. And also here is Max Brook, one of the ISF's research analysts who helped write Threat Horizon and is currently updating our guidance on threat intelligence. Hello, Max.
Hi, Mark.
So just to set the scene here, like I say, we're talking about cybercrime, cyber threat, and in my former life as a journalist, I covered that for a long time, and certainly in the early 90s when I started out as a journalist, it was quite, cybercrime wasn't really a thing because it was very quite a gentlemanly trade. Viruses, those intrusions were a nuisance more than a threat. And if they made headlines, then it was, you know, teenagers messing about, really. And if you read the biographies of a lot of the alumni of the security world now, quite a lot of them were hacking and intruding quite merrily back in those days, because it was a good way to build up those skills. And they did have that overriding hacker ethic of just being curious about these things. But it's fair to say it's got a lot more serious, a lot nastier, and a lot more lucrative as well. Max, just to come to you first, just in terms of the conversations you've had with members, ISF members, about threat intelligence, do they feel overwhelmed by this at the moment? Because they're just looking at it from a researcher point of view and from the Threat Horizon point of view. There's so much of it, and we do struggle to decide which particular threat, which innovation in that world to focus on for the reports.
Yeah, certainly. I think, you know, one thing that really stands out from a purely research standpoint is that how, you know, broad and wide this surface is and how constantly evolving it is. So that, you know, once you, it's almost like a game of whack-a-mole, really. Once you've, you know, nailed down a threat and your intelligence capabilities or your prediction, forecasting, modeling, whatever you might have to actually, you know, track that down and, you know, quash it, you know, something else just pops up. So it's, you know, every year on year, it just, this, the breadth of it just increases, you know.
Yeah, it seems to. Yeah, it seems to be one of those things that just, because like I say, whack-a-mole, arms race, there's all kinds of ways to characterize it. But James, from, like I say, from more the inside in that your company Digital Shadows studies this, tracks this, is it more understandable from your point of view? Does it break down into particular groups and actually you can see that it is much less of a tidal wave and much more of a, I'm not sure what the opposite of a tidal wave is, but it, you know, just the other way, it's easier to understand what's going on there than people might assume.
I think even people that study this get surprised, and actually part of the power of an attack is the surprise element. So it's not, yeah, I kind of expect the unexpected is some of it, I suppose. But I actually also see it evolving, right? So it's not like a step change. It's watching how behaviors have changed, but they've changed gradually over time. I guess if you think about, you know, crime always finds a way to sort of adapt a film
Jurassic
phrase.
Park. Yes. Quite common.
And to use another film phrase, show me the money. So it's, you know, it economic you know, fraud is attractive to people who want to make a lot of money. It's quite interesting you sort of bring up the sort of teenage hacker culture thing from maybe sort of 10 years ago. But yeah, you know, if you think of, look at Lapsus, for example, this teenager that's sort of recently arrested in Oxford in relation to that group, he'd amassed a vast fortune of cryptocurrency. That same teenager 10 years ago probably wouldn't have chased the money in quite the same way, or didn't have the opportunities to chase that in quite the same way. So it's an evolution of the environment as much as the evolution of the actors themselves.
Yeah, certainly that opportunity to make money is far easier now that crypto has definitely helped this. Yeah, I saw a great characterization of that Lapsus group, because obviously everyone knows about advanced persistent threats, but this characterization called them advanced persistent teenagers. And you know, they have time, they don't have money, well, they're getting the money, but and they are well motivated, and they know how to, that rising tide of computer literacy, I think, is, you know, is driving a lot of this. Because certainly, again, thinking about some stories I wrote and some of the people behind it, they, because the UK police, in fact, a lot of police forces do work with teenagers who've taken the wrong step and tried to educate them about, well, use your skills in other ways. And some of them were just intruding a bit too far. And there were some very telling quotes from them sort of saying, yeah, and that was the point at which I'd realized I'd gone too far. And it was just, yeah, that was, you know, they get the knock on the door and it all goes terribly wrong for them. But I think, yeah, it does seem, is it interesting what you say about the evolving aspect of it? Because certainly one of the things we called out in the Threat Horizon report was triple extortion, which seems to be, you know, the new hot trend in ransomware. And you know, triple because I suppose the first extortion is ransom demand, the second one is exposing that confidential info, and the third is going after your customers or their data and just using that as a springboard. So, I mean, can we expect more? Is there going to be four levels of extortion here? Or I don't know, hard to predict where they're going to go next, but is that, I guess, you can't predict it, but...
The entrepreneurial flair is not dead, is it? So, you've any way to maximize profits is the key, and I think triple extortion was obviously an evolution, but I think it's very, if you look at ransomware in particular, it's very opportunistic. Any opportunity that is presented will be taken, and I think gone are the days where you used to have sort of risk owners that would say, well, you know, my company's not very interesting. I'm not likely to be attacked because, you know, why would my computers be interesting? I think, you know, all risk practitioners really understand, you know, yep, if you've got a computer on the internet, you're potentially a target for this stuff.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think those days of, you know, like I say, organizations stepping back and going, I'll worry about this later, it just does not happen. I think everybody's potential. I think as well, there is some of this is a bit directed. But Max, I just wonder, from the interviews you've done, is ransomware that's top of mind for everybody? They just don't want to get caught out because I guess the cleanup, the every aspect of that kind of attack and being hit by it is just going to cause so many issues for organizations.
Yeah, hugely. I think as well, it's... you know, it's obviously the actual impacts of the ransomware itself, but it's also larger now. You know, the consequences of something like this are enormous in terms of media coverage and public awareness, and brand reputation has been a really big thing that has come out through some of these interviews, that organizations are, you know, looking to protect this, which is a pretty largely intangible, you know, aspect of an organization, but it's hugely important today, and the ability for information and stories to travel so fast globally to ensure that, you know, that brand reputation is protected and is, you know, is a really critical asset in its own right.
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah, because but I suppose as well, the ISF angle on this is recovery. I mean, that's kind of what we're interested in, isn't it? Sort of making sure organizations are resilient and can recover if it does go wrong. Because I guess no one these days, I imagine this is the case, that no one these days assumes their defenses are perfect. Everybody has to assume they're going to get hit, going to get caught out, and has to react on that basis.
I think people are talking about resilience, aren't they? Have been talking about resilience for a while. So really, if resilience and recovery comes as part and parcel of that, which is, I think that's a really positive way to think. I really, you know, assuming the bad thing will happen, then sort of how do you limit its scope and how do you protect the brand, to your point, Max? You know, how do you lower the, increase the cost for the attacker whilst lower the price of the impact that you might pay.
Yeah, and certainly we've seen that, I think, with, again, there's another threat we mentioned in Threat Horizon was about the attacks on crypto by the authorities just trying to increase those costs of admin for the bad guys. And I think that has driven some of that innovation because they've had to find other ways around, well, ways around that, or prosper and maybe get nastier. So I think I'm right in saying that there are less attacks around, but the returns the bad guys are getting are going up. Is that right?
I've seen some research that would support that. So I do some work with a couple of different professional organizations. There's one set of research that a friend of mine has been looking at the payments to crypto wallets in ransom attacks, and it's the number of bad people or the number of addresses to which payments are made are not actually changed that dramatically, but the value of those payments is just a whole order of magnitude different. So when you hear these big numbers, it's very easy to sort of assume, oh well, there's lots more bad people in the world sort of exploiting this stuff. Actually, no, it's roughly the same number, but they're just being much more effective at doing it, partly because of the environment, you know, presents more opportunities, but partly because of the way that they've learned to do it has evolved too.
Yeah, I think it seems right, doesn't it? Just that I think as well, we're seeing that change in the ecosystem as well. Some of people, I think there's particular targets they go after. And as well, I think they do their own intelligence work on who's likely to pay up. We've certainly seen attacks on insurers to get information about people who are insured, so they know that they're going to get a payout if they do attack them. So there's, you know, they go all ways around.
I think also the did you see the Ronin network attack recently? So it's a game that's played in Asia, and they're sort of basically marketing off these non-fungible tokens, and there's this sort of payment infrastructure inside the game which, you know, all about these sort of characters called Axies, and it's become a huge thing, and they hold the wallets on the servers. The game became hugely successful, so the operators of the game just loosened some of the controls, and before you know it, $615 million worth of cryptocurrency walks off without the knowledge of, which apparently the operators of the game were oblivious to for several months. And it's just because they hadn't prioritized security, or they'd accepted users at the expense of some of the security controls. You know, and like, if that was your bank, it would probably be different. But there's $615 million to sat on this server. And of course, opportunity presents itself, and it was taken.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds so familiar. Again, as a former hack, just writing stories about fast moving web properties that emphasize growth over everything else. I mean, partly because they have to, because they're growing fast and they're a bit of a rocket ride. And if they don't, then there's lots of competitors waiting in the wings. But equally, you just see them get caught out time after time. I mean, it's just, that sort of, oh, maybe we should have worried about that earlier, which is always, you know, definitely the benefit of hindsight in these kind of things. But I wonder if we can talk briefly about crypto, because I guess this wouldn't be happening if the crypto wasn't there, if those cryptocurrencies didn't make it easier to cash in. I mean, it's helpful in a lot of ways, but it's certainly helped the bad guys to make money out of this kind of thing.
Yeah, I guess.
Not sure what to say about crypto really apart from that, but it's again, another vast and growing ecosystem, I suppose.
Well, it's new, isn't it? So when you do new things, you either win or learn, and some people are learning in quite an amazing way. I think there's been some really good reports written by people like Elliptic or Chain Analysis, if you follow those two companies. Analyzing sort of what's happening in sort of this decentralized finance world. And, you know, you look at things like the Poly network that was recently. So that's a platform that's designed to exchange value between different coin types. We saw basically a flaw in the way that worked. The person who lifted the money said, oh, I was just doing it to show a vulnerability in the platform. And of course, you know, they also conveniently got hundreds of millions of dollars in the process well.
Funny that.
I innovation creates opportunity in all directions. And I guess that's what we're really seeing with this sort of decentralized finance and new ways of holding value. They're just creating new opportunities, both positive ones for our economy and the way the world works, but also negative ones for those that are willing to exploit those resources.
Yeah, I've been doing a bit of work on NFTs and crypto and things like that, and it just is astonishingly complicated. And I think that's where a lot of this, like I say, just will fall down. It's just really difficult to unpick the relationships or just understand how some of it works. And admittedly, I'm not a cryptographer and a very, very poor developer programmer, but it's still it's the most complicated thing that I've seen for a long time, having seen the web 1.0, 2.0, and now 3.0. It's an interesting movement, but I'm not sure where it's going to go.
Yeah, it's not going to get, well, I don't know. I mean, so your report pulls regulation as sort of unintended consequences of regulation as well. I guess the other thing is, like, if you think about how traditional bank fraud works, you know, you move money from one account to another, you're trying to make it untraceable, you use remittance to move funds sort of as far away from the original source as you can. And then this whole sort of recovery industry started up around bank fraud and actually got quite good at recovering some of those funds. We're going to see the same innovation happen around digital currency. It's just that the opportunities presented for things like laundering money in... You know, it's quite an attractive system for doing that because it's not as mature from a regulatory perspective. As regulation increases, it will push that fraud out more to the fringes. But, you know, it's we're not done yet. We're still, this is the gold rush that people are still trying to make, you know, extract the gold from. So we're going to see a lot more innovation first and probably a lot more falls and stumbles along the way.
I just wonder, Max, I mean, you're by far the youngest member of this this group. So I just wonder, is crypto a big thing with your cohort, your age group? I mean, my kids who are late teens occasionally mention it, but they've got some friends of theirs who really bought into it, literally in some cases, and others have NFTs and this, that, and the other. But I don't know, is it
I think, I think you kind of hit it on the nail on the head there. I think, you know, with my cohort, there's an understanding, you know, a sort of base level generic understanding of it, you know, among a fair few of us. But I'd say there does tend to be a select handful of those who've really bought in. So I think, you know, I think it's, there's almost a division. I think it's replicated, you know, cross societal and, you know, cross generational, that there is a, you know, an understanding of what crypto is at a very, very base level. But then there's those that have really bought into it and understand, you know, not only the economics of it, but also that really in-depth sort of technical aspect of how this actually works and it's put together, which is, you know, not something that I could, you know, adequately explain.
No, I think that's certainly the barrier. I'd like to know more about how it might or might not work.
And it's a language barrier, I suppose, in a way.
Yeah, some of that. And I think I suspect some of those fans are people who've made money out of it. That's always a good spur to talking something up.
That might be a case.
because it's certainly for. There's a really great newsletter I'm subscribed to called Garbage Day, which is all about web culture, and it's majored me a lot on crypto and NFTs, and just some of the things that have gone on there are like, okay, definitely something new and different going on there, but it's not clear to me what is emerging from the far end. But obviously, you know, the bad guys are big fans of this at the moment. But just go back to the bad guys. I just wonder if we can talk about Ukraine and Russia, because I guess that's one of the big issues at the moment. Again, Max, is that featuring on a lot of the conversations you're having? Are people shoring up defences? But I guess unpredictable those to what impact it might have on them.
Yeah, I think, you know, unpredictability at the moment is the key word. But, you know, there's definitely a distinction between organisations who've, you know, made that decision to pull their operations out of either country or region, and those who haven't. So I think it's that crossover between, you know, cyber defense and information security, but also how that's tied into wider, you know, geopolitical sort of considerations and implications that are actually starting to blur the boundaries between one of the two, I think.
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah, some of those. I just wonder, James, has it had an impact on the community of cybercrime operators? Because I guess my impression of that group, those people, is that they are very loosely coupled. They weren't particularly nationalistic, but I guess they've become more of that. I don't know. I'm curious about that impact.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's been really, as a practitioner in this area, it's been really interesting to watch. I guess there's two main themes here. One is how hacktivism has just had a real boost. And, you know, there's got the IT army of the Ukraine, which is sort of a Ukrainian government sponsored group where they just appeal to anyone to sort of jump on in and attack targets that are named in the day. And there's like ridiculous, 415,000 people around the world coordinated on that Telegram group, which is strange and surreal and dangerous. Don't do it, kids. It's not a good idea. You'll end up with a Computer Misuse Act infringement. And then you've got the old moniker of Anonymous, which has suddenly become much more coordinated, potentially some really big targets, right? Some really big scalps, like train systems and power systems. And, are they really just people in their basements sort of contributing, or is that a front for some other sort of geopolitical country capability?
Because I saw something today which suggested, well, I don't know if I believe it, because who believes what on the internet about Anonymous getting into Kremlin cameras in the Kremlin, which is just like, okay, who knows what's going to emerge from that.
But, Central Bank of Russia stuff, that was really, really interesting. There was a 21 gig archive dropped last week on that one. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I think didn't they delete databases of one of the Russian air agencies as well. So it's big, nasty stuff, for sure.
Yeah, it's definitely some serious capabilities. I guess the other big theme there is looking at the criminal groups themselves, as you were sort of mentioning. So there is a lot of cybercrime that is Russophone. There are other languages too, but Russophone, so Russian-speaking groups are there. Of course, Ukrainians quite often speak Russian as well. And there's two particular gangs in question, so Conti and Lockbit, both of whom have both Russian and Ukrainian members, so as members from the Russian Federation and from the Ukraine. And they basically split in half. And you saw Conti basically leaking itself to the world, which is just like it's a very happy day for threat researchers when 2 years of chat logs drop on a file server, wow, which you can forensically sort of, like, we still got people going through those because they dropped nearly a month ago and we still get updates quite regularly from the group. And you've got 2 years of insight to chat logs. And you learn sort of crazy things like they only work Monday. Well, they work Monday to Friday mostly. You know, they have fairly mundane existences. They visit partners' barbecues on the weekend. And
They're real people.
Yeah, they're just real people like you and me. And actually, not everyone is a mega millionaire. A lot of people just have regular salary. It's like a salary job.
No way. Oh, really?
Yeah. Gosh.
Yeah. I did wonder about that because I, having read a few analyses of those groups, and I think one of them was likened it to drug groups. Typically, you have some people at the top who make a lot of money, and an awful lot of soldiers and peons down the bottom who make hardly anything and are just scrabbling for the status and etc. and money and all this kind of, and I guess similar kind of thing.
Yeah, well, it's almost like that, but also like a pyramid scheme because you've got this affiliate structure as well. So not only, so you've got people who are rented the sort of core capabilities of the ransomware actor, and then the affiliates who are basically using that to then go and make a profit. So they're taking all the risk, but and seeing some of the profit, but not all of it.
I think they're that fascinating dark mirror of the real software world. I guess there must be a lot of, if you compare the lifestyles of, I know somebody works for Facebook and somebody works for one of those crime groups. Yeah, there are probably some commonalities in terms of code they're pushing and just this, that, and the other. It would be quite similar. But just to end on a more positive note, are there? I guess organisations aren't at the complete mercy of these groups. Max, I guess, do you get that impression from the people you've been talking to? They're not throwing their hands up in despair and saying, "Why do I bother?" It's, you know, there are things that they can do and there are defenses they can put in place, and they can survive and come back and recover.
Yeah, and I think in the context of updating this report on threat intelligence, that there is certainly, although there is a huge variety and range of these types of actors and the threats that organizations are facing, what has been really clear is that actually, it's almost scary to be aware of them, but they know that they have the capabilities to defend against them. And whether that's a reactive or a proactive measure, they tend to, having that awareness is actually really, really important for them. And it's, a bonus and actually a positive.
There's a really nice set of insights we've gained about the behaviours. And the like stuff like way Active Directory is configured, just doing that really well makes a huge difference. And they're all they are opportunistic. So actually, if you have well configured defenses, you approach those systems like an attacker. You try and defend them. Genuinely, you will significantly reduce your risk, and it's actually more your supply chain that you might need to worry about.
Yeah, that's certainly been highlighted. Yeah, and I think there's been a fair amount of both formal and informal intelligence sharing as well, and collaboration. You know, I think large events tend to perk up those involved and the organizations which might be threatened by it. But on a base level, there does tend to be people who are looking beyond that competitive nature of intelligence gathering and sharing to actually use it as a way of just raising the base level at an industrial sort of an industry wide scale.
Yeah, that's good to hear. I think I do get the impression that across a lot of industries, there's a feeling that we're all in this together, and that more information helps everybody for sure. Thank you, everybody. Thanks, James. Thanks, Max. And thank you, everyone, for listening. You can find more podcasts on the ISF podcast channel or at securityforum.org, where you can also learn more about ISF research, tools, and guidance. Thanks for listening.